All right. Thanks very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It is a pre-fireworks celebration here in the Allstate Showcase Studio along Michigan Avenue. And so on Mondays, we always talk with the folks from Chicago Inno. Will Flanagan, the general manager, is here. Karis Husted is in the studio as well. And, well, they are probably the most valuable guests on the Wintrust Business Lunch because a lot of times Monday's on a holiday, and I'm always here, and they're always here, too. This isn't quite a holiday, but I do appreciate you guys coming in today.
Happy, safe 4th,
Don't
Steve.
Say it. Don't say it. Karis, thanks yep. for coming. I'll talk Happy just to you instead. Now, I was telling them off the air, but let's just do this a little bit.
Yeah.
Since you brought it up, I don't like it when people wish me a... if you think of our language, this is the point of what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. If you think of our language, we are so fear driven now. We're so driven by what can go wrong to where now the salutation for the 4th of July is have a safe 4th.
Yeah.
And it's almost like we're going into a danger zone or a war zone because we're going to go to a picnic in our neighbor's backyard. Have a safe 4th.
So the only way to count is just to go on the complete other end and just wish people just like, crazy, have, right? like have a dangerous get, radical 4th. Yeah.
Hey, your eye is going to get, blown off anyway. So like just do right. what you're going to do.
Don't bother with a seatbelt because you're not coming home anyway. Right.
Exactly.
Okay. So that public service announcement brought to you by Will Flanagan. All right, so there is a pretty remarkable piece in the New York Times at the end of the month. Was it earlier? I guess it was Friday, right? Would have been Friday, about the sexism and the inappropriate behavior in the tech world. And it's something that we've talked about. It's stuff that's come up from time to time. But I don't know. I just was taken aback by how direct this was, how they named names.
And, yeah.
Short of charges or anything like that, they name names prompting apologies?
Yeah, absolutely. So the reason why this story really came out is when you have an issue that is so prevalent and this isn't an issue that just bubbles up every now and then. It is every day. Every day there is an inclusiveness problem in Silicon Valley and in the tech industry. These stories
more so than in other industries.
That's what it sounds like, okay. Steve. Right? And you hear it over and over again. And one of the reasons why it's in the public discourse right now is because of a venture capitalist, Justin Galbeck, who was exposed as somebody who was really taking advantage of his position of power. Really well known, famed VC. And over the past couple weeks has been fired. All these stories came out. And it was one of those where he was just like, it was an open secret that he was a bit of a dog. And just people kind of realizing this, like, that's not a secret. That's a problem.
Right, right.
So because all of a sudden Galbeck was in the news and everyone was talking about it, everyone kind of, it's like, well, this, it happened here and it happened there. So this New York Times story, really what they did is it wasn't just here's the problem exposed through the vacuum of one story. It's here's 25 founders commenting about all of these. And it's not just experiences with VCs, but other founders, people at accelerators. Silicon Valley in tech in general, and that's something we're going to talk about as well, has a problem. Like big problems, they're complicated, right? There's not one reason why this is. Probably anytime you have an industry that is dominated by one gender, class, or type of people, you have just inherent inexclusiveness problems. So what's been interesting is this week we did a Women in Inno event. And we learned really this isn't a Silicon Valley problem. Right. This is a tech problem that happens everywhere.
And Karis, you were there, right?
Yeah, and that's what's really important to remember about this. I'm glad you brought up that it's not necessarily something that's just happening in a vacuum. It's not a company by company problem. It's really more of a systemic problem. So we had a Women in Inno event. We brought in VCs and founders to talk about their companies, some of the issues they face, and some of the problems they've seen.
It wasn't just about this by any means.
No, it wasn't just about this. We brought it up just because, there are women in innovation. Sure. Let's, give them a platform and talk about, but there are issues that do need to be addressed because there are problems here. So throughout the event, we talked with a VC who actually asked the women in the room based off this story about Justin Galbeck, how many of you have been sexually harassed in the workplace? And over half of the room raised their hand. This was a room of 100 women who would all come together in the tech world. So I think what's important to remember is that it's not necessarily a problem in a vacuum. It's more of a much larger problem than that. That's often nuanced. It's often complicated, but it also is something that needs to be talked about.
and it's not why it's so complicated is the Justin Goldbeck of, you know, making advances and sending really uncomfortable text messages that anybody would look at and say, ooh, that's inappropriate. If that was the problem, then you can identify it and fix it. But to Karis's point, the issue is that probably a lot of the actions that triggered that hand raise at the event were probably as part of actions that they didn't even know was inappropriate.
You mean so the actors, the inappropriate.
Yeah, so part of it is just continuing to have this public discourse and to realize that yes, you don't have to send a lewd text message for it. Like, that's not all that sexual harassment can be. It can be making your colleague inappropriate. Chris Sacco, another venture capitalist who's signaled in the New York Times, you know, he is put under this umbrella of sexual harassment, but the action that he's being accused of doing is touching a face. You know, that is different than what Justin Goldbeck, but it is another thing that contributes to this problem.
But I think something that's really important to remember, too, is right now I think people are giving this more attention because it's always been sort of an open secret in tech that there are people who kind of act, you know, uncomfortably. And because of that, if you speak out against it, there are often negative repercussions. So,
well, they suffer. Then if you complain, and the New York Times talked about that quite a bit.
Yeah, there was one woman who somebody who she was trying to get hired at a job. He had said, I don't know if I should hire you or hit on you. And when she brought it up to another colleague, they basically said, you know, that's going to impact your chance of getting a job here. So I think that's important too, is that before there haven't necessarily been negative consequences for the people who have been inappropriate, but now we're starting to see some pushback. And my hope is that this will then make people think twice about, should I stroke someone's face?
Yeah.
To me, the answer is no, never. No, right. Like, never. There's never an appropriate time to do that. But
could you stupidly stroke someone's face and not mean anything more by it?
Maybe if it's like your best friend, I think. But other than that, I don't want anybody touching my face.
I'm not even going to make a joke.
No, here's the thing, and this is the public service announcement. If you have to have that internal debate, is this inappropriate? It's inappropriate. Like, if you have
it might not be,
but just defaults to no.
It's not advisable.
Default to no. Right. If you have to say, like, you know what, this might be the real, but let me go
or
for it.
Or would I do this to a male colleague?
Exactly.
I think that's
right.
A big thing, is that, like, no, Chris Sacco is probably not going to do that to his, like, male colleague. I mean, it's not going to happen. So right. I think that's the other thing, too, is thinking about.
Okay, so
happens.
When I was reading this and wondering about it, I'm thinking, oh, this is a money thing. This is a power. These are the VC people, and they've got power, and this is another way to exercise their power. But it's not just the money people. Mm-hmm. Right?
It's bosses, it's accelerators. It kind of goes across the board. I mean, even on small tech teams, like, women aren't as represented in development teams or something along those lines. So it can be hard if one person who is on the team says something uncomfortable, but again, they don't want to bring it up because they're worried about negative consequences.
Yeah, and one of the stories that actually happened before the Goldbeck news broke that kind of triggered this this discussion was the Uber employees blog post that kind of set the path for Travis Kalanick to resign, where she exposed this unbelievably toxic culture of just mistreatment and harassment. And the people kind of identified and discussed in the blog post were her fellow engineers and her managers. It's not just, you know, creepy VCs. It's everywhere. It's
a breakdown
everywhere.
In the HR as well. That was the other big thing about that blog post, is that she repeatedly brought this up to HR. And that's something women are told a lot. If there's a problem, bring it up to HR. This problem showed that it can often go deeper than
that. But are we agreed that it's a greater problem in the tech industry than it is in society at large? Or is it just getting attention in the tech industry?
No, I think it's a problem in society at large.
I know it's a problem, but I mean, is it accelerated within the tech industry, or are we just focusing on it?
It feels like it's accelerated within the tech industry based on the discussions being had. But this is also, listen, we cover tech, so I'm a fan of this industry. It's a progressive industry. I also think it is an industry full of people who get into entrepreneurship to tackle problems. And you're going to tackle a problem, you have to talk about it. So it's also an industry where I think is probably more forthcoming and transparent about this issue. So one of the reasons you're hearing so much about it is if this happened in, you know, I don't know, manufacturing, maybe that industry wouldn't contribute to the conversation the way tech is kind of saying, like, oh, wow, not only is this a problem, but hey, guys, here's our stats and gender discrimination, data that supports this. So, no, I don't think it's unique to tech, but I think tech is open to talking about
it. That's Will Flanagan and Karis Husted, both here from Chicago. You know, we're going to lighten things up and talk about end-of-life issues.
It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Kara Husted and Will Flanagan are here from Chicago, you know, around most Mondays for the front half of the show. And okay, so it's the 4th of July, and I want to talk a little bit about this new venture from New Founders created by, in part, Genevieve Thiers, who was behind Sitter City, right? Genevieve has been on the show. And I think it was last year, or was it just after the election, they talked about Rise Movement was their new sort of venture. Have they moved beyond that now? Or?
Yeah, back in December, Genevieve Thiers had announced Rise Movement, which is essentially a political party progressive campaigning that was really focused on how do we connect people in this very bipartisan way, especially in this time, this very nasty time, I think, after the election when people were pretty partisan.
And she wanted to do it in a nonpartisan but progressive way. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
I mean, like bringing people together over issues around the economy and job creation, rather than focusing on and going with the idea that everybody wants equal rights for each other, which is, I guess, a progressive idea, but more focused on economics.
I think we're so polluted when it comes to this country and issues that it's hard to imagine there being a progressive idea without being a democratic idea, right? Or a partisan democratic idea, how you can get to the kernel, and it could, because it certainly could be. I mean, there couldn't be progressive issues that would apply to a lot of Republicans as well.
Yeah, one of Rise's core points at the time was around automation, in this idea that like automation is a huge problem for the economy, and it is not a partisan issue. You Democrats will lose your jobs to automated software. You Republicans will lose your. So let's. How do we fix this? As or not fix it, but how do we work around it? And where is the new jobs going to be created around? So that was kind of the core belief, but they have pivoted or kind of launched a new tool.
Yeah, they're still. I mean, that's still kind of like the bigger idea of it. But basically, now they're thinking, how do we use technology to kind of start to get at some of these issues? So after the election, they spent a few months talking to people who had voted, why they voted. Non-voters was a huge thing, and they basically asked people, why didn't you vote in the last election? Because in the last election, it was about 60% voter turnout, still super low.
And I think midterms are like 35% or something like that.
Yeah, midterms were 36.4% in the last election. So, I mean, as we know, voter participation is a huge part of any democracy. So they said, why didn't you vote? And actually, the majority of people said they just didn't know how to. They didn't know where their polling place was. They knew how to vote in a president election, but they didn't know local elections, midterms. And so they basically said, we have to figure out a product to solve this.
That is absolutely confounding to me and infuriating to me. And in a way, I kind of understand. I mean, I don't mean to derail you, Will, but
no.
I've had conversations with friends, intelligent, close friends, and, you know, because I love politics, I love all of it, I'm in it every day, and I'm astounded by what they don't understand. And, you know, so maybe it's in the media or wherever we have this sort of arrogance that we think everyone enjoys things the way we do, and if you don't care, you might not know.
Yeah, but also the world is getting easier. Everything is getting easier to use. Think about the easy pass on your car. You used to have to go fishing for change to get through tolls, the garage door opener. I can order a sub in between segments on my phone with my credit card preloaded. Just the world is easy to use. We are constantly developing things to make your life easier, and sometimes we forget to easify, for lack of a word I just made up.
Oh, no, it's a good one. Yeah.
Easify existing processes. So we look at voting, and yes, it's easy to get frustrated at those who don't. Or we can say, let's make this easier. I know it sounds silly that we need to create software that sends apps to your, that buzzes your phone and tells you, oh, it's voting time. Here's the six places you got it. You can go, and here's when. But that's what we're going to have to do, because it's not just that voter turnout, is a problem. It's a new problem. It was a 72-year low in midterm. So to me, it's not saying like, oh, come on, it's always low and we've been fine forever. It's no, it's low. It's getting lower. So let's really fix this.
But this is what she's aiming to do, or what they're aiming to do, is give people information that you could get with a Google search pretty quickly, right? I mean, pretty easily, too.
Well, I don't know. Have you recently Googled how to vote in these things? It's not a perfect process, I think. And so this is basically bringing it to your smartphone. So it's an app. Basically, it will send alerts about your upcoming election. So you put in your zip code you go out from there. And then you can also get additional information, driving directions, exactly where you need to go.
Well, I hope she succeeds. I know I sound a little skeptical. I don't mean to. I hope it works because I want to take away every excuse anyone has.
Yeah, exactly.
Not
right.
Voting, right?
Absolutely.
So, okay, so there's that. Talk to me about after.
Yes.
Because this is really interesting to me.
Totally. This is one of my favorite types of entrepreneurial stories. You experience this personal problem and you create a business around it. So we spoke with a Chicagoan, Maggie Norris, who a couple years ago endured two family losses. And it was not just emotionally taxing, but taxing on everything, on your time, on your resources. And it's really hard to figure out what to deal with, how to deal with it, especially when, you know, the person who's going through the sickness or illness isn't maybe being forthcoming or forward. So what she did is she, based on her experiences, created After, which is a social platform. It's called an end-of-life planning platform. It provides informational healthcare videos. It organizes key legal and healthcare forms, and it coordinates kind of end-of-life care requests with stakeholders. Because when you're going through this, your mind is focused on 1,000 different things, not, you know, do we get the right signature we needed for this will or this form, or, you know, wow, how am I going to pay for the funeral? All of this stuff is, when we talk about making things easier, helping people through these, like, that is such a noble startup. So I love it. It's called After. Chicago and Maggie Norris, the beta launched this summer, and they'll be releasing the platform live later.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really important about it is any conversation around end of life is extremely emotional. I mean, this is talking about someone you love, someone you care about. And often, even for that person, their life is a point of pride. It can be hard to admit, I need help, or I don't know how this is going to work. I need [S2] Right. [S1] To share my symptoms with you. And so what I think is really interesting is it's bringing software, which is very objective. It's very not emotional. It's very clear cut. And it's bringing that to something that can be very messy and hard to deal with.
I like the idea that the information then is there, that, you know, if you have questions, you can have questions answered. Yeah. But if you don't know what your questions are even yet, right, it's all right there.
It guides the conversation.
And if there's someone worried about their if it's someone who's ill, worried about their family dealing with this or whatever, you can sit at a computer and handle so much of this on your own, I guess. So it was in beta. She wants to launch it next month, right?
Yeah. Coming out. And it's, you know, kind of going back to what I was talking about earlier. These are my favorite stories we cover on Chicago. You know, the ones where, like, I experienced something that was tough and inconvenient, and I wish I had this, and now I'm building a solution around it.
Where does she market this? Is this healthcare?
Yeah.
Or is it?
Healthcare is an option. I think that is the business plan moving forward is, you know, if you're one of many services that can help with the afterlife planning process, there is going to be a way to advertise.
I mean, I talk to a lot of financial advisors. It seems to me like this might be a fit for them as well, as they're talking about long-term and retirement or, you know, inheritance or things like that.
Yeah,
too.
Absolutely. I actually just did a story on Genivity, which is a startup here in Chicago that's bringing that health and wealth planning together for exactly that reason.
Right.
It's basically helping you better understand how much do you have to save up? How can you plan better so that you can have the financial security you need for
Cars Husted, Will Flanagan. Thanks very much for coming by. I want you to go out and have a happy
4th, Steve.
Just a happy 4th.
Fairly reckless. Have a fairly reckless 4th if you'd like. Ryan Burrow just around the corner with a look at the headlines. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, can your coffee order or maybe the car you drive sabotage your career? Richard Moran says maybe. He's the president of Menlo College, the author of the book The Thing About Work, and he joins us now on a phone line. Richard, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hey, great to be here, Steve.
You know, what I like about this book and the idea is that a lot of us, I think in life, a lot of us think we know how to behave, and so we do what we think, and we might be completely out of the norm. And so the idea here is just to kind of point out to people what's expected of you, what is acceptable behavior, even if you might not think that it is.
Yeah, well, I'm the first to admit that my books are not great literature. What they are based on my observations of what I see. And the story that you already mentioned was about how ordering coffee can be something as simple as that can have an impact. I tell the story that I was interviewing a young woman. It happened to be a woman. And, of course, we're in one of the famous corner roasteries.
Sure.
And she was great, but then she got up to the front of the line and ordered a double frappuccino with extra heat and no foam and coffee on the side with a double cup. And, I mean, it just went on and on and on. And I thought to myself, if she can't order a cup of coffee simply, what will it happen when she has a complex spreadsheet to work on?
So you thought really that it wasn't that her being inconsiderate by making you wait, but it was that she just might, a complicated drink might reflect a complicated working person?
It just struck me that she was going to be work. And sometimes at work you want to deal with people who get things done in an uncomplicated way. So it was as simple as that. And so we went on, of course, for the interview. I didn't base the entire judgment based on her, but it went on. I mean, it validated what I already knew.
Here's my thing. So you see her in that line and you make that judgment. That's the frame you're going to use the rest of the interview for.
It's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it can be so. The same applies to so many other things: how you dress, how you speak. If you're driving, a car that says something about yourself. All these little messages are sending out indicators of what you're going to be like to work with.
Are they fair indicators, Richard? I mean, it seems to me like almost we're talking about treating people unfairly by something that might be kind of peripheral.
Yeah, well, sometimes, but, we all based on our, we all look at people. We all have our own little biases. We all make judgments. And I think, especially when you're looking for a job or looking for a promotion, you just need to be aware of what those are. Luckily, though, going with your trend, Steve, the biases that so often have been in place at work are disappearing. Good example I use in the book is tattoos.
Right,
more people in the United States have tattoos than don't. So you don't need to worry about hiding your tattoo if you're interviewing. Unless it's on your face like Mike Tyson, it probably is not going to be any big deal.
I'm so glad you brought that up because we have talked about that. I've talked about it at dinner with friends who are in the position of hiring, and we've talked about it on the show. And it kind of leads to where I want to be next, because in all of this, in the impression that you're making and being conscious of that, there also are these, divergent generational views. So tell me about keeping in mind, maybe if you're a 20-something, that you're being judged fairly or unfairly by a 50-something or 40-something or 30-something.
Yeah. Well, and we all need to be aware of that. And that saw is cutting in a lot of different ways today, because it's possible that that your own boss could be 20 years younger than you.
Right.
So, yeah. So I think I'm a big believer that we need to get out of the valence business, and valence means positive and negative. And I think we just need to not judge people based on a tattoo or their age, and judge them on their skills, abilities, and their performance. But at the same time, we need to recognize that if you're that there needs to be a marriage between what you might be thinking about doing and what messages you're sending. For example, if you if you're interviewing for a job as an accountant and your arms are full of tattoos that say, screw the man, or that's probably not going to be a good indicator.
No. I guess the point is too that there's two ways to look at it. There's one is it fair? But maybe that's a little less relevant to what signal might it send out, even unfairly, that might keep you from getting a job or being promoted. So those are sort of the surface issues. But there are a lot of number of other things I want to talk to you about when you talk about the do's and don'ts at work. And one of them that I think might be lost on a lot of people is just show up. Do show up. Be in the office. A lot of us dream of working from home, but that makes you a little more expendable, too.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, that's the subtitle of the book, you know, showing up in other important matters, because it does still matter that you show up for a couple of reasons. One, the main reason why we like work, any job I've ever had, the big reason is I like work because of the people I work with, the colleagues I have, the partners I've had, the great relationships I've developed with coworkers. And if you're never there, you can't do that.
Right.
And the second reason is because, you know, lots of times the person who is the most expendable is the person that no one knows and the person that really has been working remotely for the last couple of months. But we all like to think that that's going to be more productive. But I know whenever I work from home, you know, the UPS guy is ringing the doorbell, the dogs need to go out, the kids need to get picked up. Sometimes I think working from home, you know, there's a vision of it that is not quite as accurate as the reality of it.
I was talking to my daughter last night, and she's in an internship program, a great program. And she said she's kind of like sees sort of that she's kind of a project manager. I'm like, wow, I'm reading this book. I'm talking to the guy tomorrow. And he said, the one thing you really need to do is find a way to become a quote unquote project manager, because that's really valuable when it comes to the next job and beyond.
Absolutely. In fact, work today is broken down into projects. And if you can manage a project, you're going to be really successful. And the groups who have figured that out the best are both the high-tech companies and the big consulting firms. They break the world down into projects, and they want you to learn how to manage a project. And if that means staying up all night, if that means meeting the deadline no matter what, if that means bringing in help as you need it, whatever it takes, but that project is going to be done on time, on budget, and it's going to be successful.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Richard.
And that skill is highly undervalued, I think. So I tell all college graduates that learn how to manage a project.
What do you mean when you say pay attention to the career clock? I'm not sure I get that.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of a metaphor that I was speaking to, a person who's probably in his 50s, and he said that his career clock was ticking. And the implication is sort of like the metaphor of, you know, a woman might say, you know, their baby clock or their pregnancy clock is ticking.
Right.
He was saying that, you know, I have two or three jobs left. And so I really want to make the right decisions as I look forward on my next job. So a career clock is actually something that we need to pay attention to, because there is ageism. I mean, older people have a harder time finding jobs, especially in technology. And I think we just need to realize, you know, where we are in our career and what kind of job we're looking for, and recognize that there needs to be a marriage there.
Does that mean if you spend too much time at a lower level because you love the job that you might be, you know, creating trouble for your career clock down the road?
Maybe, but, you know, if you love your job, and no matter what the level, you know, maybe you should keep it. But I think there is an element of age and where you are in your career. So, for example, I'm too old to be a Navy pilot. I'm too old to get into medical school. I'm too old. I mean, there's a long list of things that I'm too old for. But I think we all need to recognize that at a certain age, there is some expectation that you're at a certain level, and that it means something in the success of your career.
Richard Moran is the author of the book, The Thing About Work. Richard, thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Great, Steve. Thanks.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's 12:51. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, Ryan, thanks for that. And thanks for that news from Fitch. It's sort of the, well, you're trying award, I guess. So we'll see. The Senate, I think, is just in session at noon. I think they're probably going to caucus for a while, so we'll see what happens there. Randy Schaefer is in the studio. She is a digital news editor for the Chicago Tribune, and she comes by to talk about what's new in social media. Randy Schaefer, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Well, hey, thank you for having me.
You've got real big 4th of July plans, do you?
A little beach, a little barbecue. I think the same plans everyone kind of has this week.
It's going to be perfect for it, too. A beautiful day tomorrow, I think. All right, so, well, let's start. You brought this story in about what people like and don't like to see on social media, on Facebook, and the big complaint is that they don't. Well, let me just say this. If I were to go, I was just on Facebook during a break because, well, it was research, and let me see if it's still there. The first thing that came up was my memory, and it was a memory from a year ago, and it was from me on the St. George Bridge in Prague. Something I'd posted a year ago today.
And that sounds like something that most people don't want to see on their feeds.
So it was a vacation picture, and people are complaining that they don't want to see other people's vacation pictures?
Yeah, so there's this new study that was timed to release, of course, with vacation season, where a majority of social media users, 70-something, 72, 77, I forget the exact figure, they don't want to see your vacation photos on their social media feeds.
Well, I'm guilty, I guess.
Cause, sounds like it.
Okay, but I'll plead that mine's a little different because it's business too, right? So I do a travel business, and I want people to see that we have great times on these trips. We do, and so. Do I get a pass?
This sounds legit to me. As long as you're not posting the hot dogs or legs photo, because that seems to be the one that most Facebook users have a big issue with.
What are hot dogs or legs?
The photo, you know, of a young lady is sitting poolside with her knees propped up in front of her, a drink in her hand, and her legs are bare because she's wearing a swimsuit, and so she captions it, hot dogs or legs.
Very nice. Well, I wouldn't do that. No, I wouldn't do that. But what percentage of people then, 77% say they don't like to see other people's vacation pictures. What percentage of those people actually post their vacation pictures?
I think it's 72%, so it's it's pretty close.
You know, but I guess there is that. In fact, my wife talks about that, how she didn't, when we would go out on trips, you know, I would be posting all the time. And she's like, well, I don't want to do too many days in a row because people just
get overwhelmed by it.
And it becomes like maybe you're bragging or something. Oh, I'm here and you're not.
Well, especially with the whole real-time aspect, because I know when I was a kid, you know, we'd go to Disney World with a family and then we'd have the photos and we'd show them at family gatherings like 2-3 months after the fact, and it was kind of fun. But now it's like, you know, it's 9 a.m. on 4th of July, you're working the holiday, you're sitting at your desk, and Bob is uploading photos from his Jamaican vacation.
Hot dogs are legs.
Hot dogs are legs, Joe.
All right, so I do want to apologize for everyone who's put out by my travel pictures, but I probably won't stop. Randy Schaefer here. Oh, talk to me about Instagram as well. They're owned by Facebook, right?
Yeah, Instagram is owned by Facebook.
Now, Facebook has, you can divide that down into specific friends lists, and is that something Instagram's looking at?
Yeah, so Facebook's privacy settings are very, very detailed. You can post something for the public, you can post it for public and friends. You can even make certain lists. I know when I was in college, I had a list called People to Hide Drunk Photos From. And so you can actually choose audience-wise who sees your photos. And it looks like Instagram might be getting ready to kind of do the same thing.
But that would change kind of what Instagram's about. Isn't it very public now?
Yeah, Instagram is one of two things. It's either very public or very private. You can either let your profile be seen by the world or keep it locked down. There's no in between. And so what this update Instagram is looking at doing, it would allow users to create a favorites list and then post photos that can only be seen by people on that list.
What do you mean you could keep it public or locked down?
So with Instagram right now, there are two settings. You can either have a private profile or a public profile. There's no in between. You can't share a photo with some people but not others. It's either all or nothing.
I see. So you could. So if it's a private profile, you're still allowing people in.
Yeah, you're allowing people to follow you, but if someone doesn't follow you, they can't see anything.
I got you. Okay. Well, does this work? Do lists like that work generally with social media?
I know I use them a lot. I have people, you know, journalists I follow on Facebook. If I just want to see news stories, I'll click over to my journalist list, or, you know, I'll have photos, like I said, that I don't want family members to see, or, you know, you don't want grandma to see something.
Can you show me an example? Let me see. What are you talking about?
You're lucky we're on the radio right now. I'm only joking, but this could be it.
That was the most insincere I'm only joking I've ever heard.
I'm only joking. but this change could be good for, you know, people who have a brand, or marketers or bloggers that like to show certain aspects of their life. You know, maybe they want to show a photo of a family member that recently passed and it doesn't fit up with their brand. And
right.
So this way they can share it to certain people, but not to others.
Okay. You just said something about showing just a particular aspect of their life that made me think of another story you gave me. I think it was from CNN.com.
Yes.
And they talked to a series of couple travel bloggers. Yes. How do they put that?
Instagram couples.
Instagram
quotes.
Couples. Okay. But these are people who basically they just... I think the ones I read, they just travel around and then they post pictures of their trip.
Yeah, and it's always interesting because my first thought when I see people like this is, how do you afford that? And these couples, either they run blogs or some of them, one of these couples, they worked odd jobs so that they could kind of like make some money here and there so they could keep traveling in their 80 square foot van or camper, RV, whatever you want to call it.
But from what I read about from the article, it was like, yeah, we're not really having that much fun.
Yeah, it was kind of shocking to see how much of this is actually a show and how many of these couples, they fight or bicker or, you know, all they do is work and they're not really enjoying this travel that they seem to be enjoying that, you know, 72, 77% of people yeah. don't want to see anyway.
It was pretty interesting where they said, look, you just don't, one of the women in particular said, I don't believe what you see. I mean, believe what you see. The pictures are great, but it doesn't really reflect the lifestyle we're living.
Exactly.
Because we just can't keep it up.
Exactly.
I just finished watching Crashing on Netflix last night. You know that series?
No, I don't.
It's a 6-episode series. It's pretty good. And I'm always looking for new sorts of shows, and I find myself going to Netflix or Amazon more than anywhere else. There was a piece about how Netflix utilizes social media better than the others do.
Yeah, so this is interesting, and I actually couldn't figure out exactly why, but Netflix, part of the reason Netflix is so successful is because of how viral it is, and you look at shows like 13 Reasons Why, and what was the other show they gave an example of?
Oh, it was the What's Something, yeah, they just canceled it, I think.
I can't think of the name of it off the top of my head. But shows on Netflix tend to get more interaction on Twitter than shows from Hulu or shows from Amazon. And Netflix really kind of has this social media marketing.
Is that because aspect. They released the episodes all at once?
I'm not entirely sure, but that might have something to do with it. Although, you know, shows like The Walking Dead, I don't know if you ever
right,
see on Twitter,
sure.
that has a huge Twitter following. But for some reason, Netflix really has this cornered.
Randy Schaefer, thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Have a great holiday.